This episode of the Organic BC Podcast was funded in part by Agriculture and Agri-Food Canada through the BC Climate Agri-Solutions Fund, delivered by Investment Agriculture Foundation of BC. This is the Organic BC Podcast, and I'm your host, Jordan Marr. In this episode, a conversation with soil scientist Matthew Rourke.
Hello, I'm Matt Rourke. I'm a professor in the Department of Soil Science at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and I do research and extension in the area of soil fertility, nutrient management, with a focus on cover crops and manure.
But let's back up for a minute. BC's got a lot of intensive dairy production, and those operations spread a lot of manure on their fields each year, which can be great for the soil and for future crops, but can also lead to environmental problems when nitrogen and phosphorus in that manure ends up polluting waterways via leaching or soil erosion. It was this problem, nutrient pollution from manure spreading, and one of its solutions, planting a cover crop, that I had in mind when I reached out to Matthew Rourke from the University of Wisconsin-Madison. I had just read some research that Matthew co-authored on the agronomic trade-offs of growing a cover crop following a manure application. Even better, the specific context of this research was a fall cover crop planted after a manure application that took place after a corn silage crop. Dairy producers here in BC grow a lot of corn silage, so the insights of Matthew's research seemed pretty relevant. So I called Matthew and we talked about nutrient pollution in general and the use of a cover crop after a manure application after a silage corn crop, and some strategies a farmer can use to reduce the agronomic trade-offs of using cover crops to reduce nitrogen pollution. The research in question is called Cover Crops, Manure, and Nitrogen Management, and I've linked to a summary of that research in the show notes for this episode. I think that's all I need to tell you. Here's my conversation with Matthew Rourke.
Matthew, thanks a lot for joining me on the Organic British Columbia podcast.
Yeah, great to be here.
So, primarily, Matthew, I asked you to join me because we're going to take a look at the benefits and trade-offs of using cover crops following manure applications with the goal of managing nutrient pollution or potential nutrient pollution. And we're going to specifically focus on corn crops probably, and even more specifically on corn silage crops. But before we get into that and some of the research you've done, I was hoping you could talk a little bit about the history of nutrient management in Wisconsin, particularly around dairy production. In other words, I am assuming that this has been a growing concern or a concern for some time. Like, you know, intensive dairy production implies application of manures to our soils with a lot of good intentions, but also because otherwise it becomes a form of waste product. So am I right in assuming that the potential for nutrient pollution from those manure applications is something that farmers and the government and academics like yourself take seriously in Wisconsin?
No, absolutely. And there's been decades and decades of research related to manure use for both as a nutrient source and as a source of nitrogen and phosphorus lost to ground and surface waters. And so a lot of that research connects to, you know, nutrient availabilities for manure, you know, what are appropriate rates of manure to apply to supply adequate nutrients, but also where are the issues when it comes to using manure and how it affects water quality. So related, we also have rules within the state on how farmers need to manage their manure, what the rules are related to their manure applications. And so that's connected to something that we have in the state, a phosphorus index, which calculates risk of manure, you know, what's the risk of phosphorus loss as it relates to manure applications. And all of those things get bundled into our nutrient management tool that we have here at the university that's supported by the state. So called SNAP Plus. So farmers, co-ops, large dairies can use these tools to help manage their manure.
Okay. And so presumably, like, we have similar tools and programs up in British Columbia. Presumably there was a period when these tools weren't in place. And can you speak at all to, like, I guess, I'm just making assumptions, but this must have been preceded by a time where you were experiencing serious issues with water pollution inadvertently from certain practices.
You know, it's interesting though, Wisconsin's as far back as when I started as a graduate student, Wisconsin was a real leader in utilizing a phosphorus index and having it being implemented in in regulations and in a management structure. So I've always had an eye on Wisconsin and what's been going on since certainly the late 90s. But before that, right, the big issue is that we have a lot of cows, right? We have a lot of manure application, and we have a buildup of phosphorus in our soils in some situations, right? And that causes a risk for increasing the amount of phosphorus and runoff off mm-hmm. of the landscape and into surface water bodies. And a big chunk of our watershed, you know, a big chunk of the state flows into the Great Lakes. And so that becomes an issue when it comes to Lake Michigan. With nitrogen, we're thinking a little bit more on the leaching through the soil profile into groundwater, right? And so we've got a lot of, you know, we certainly have hot spots in our state with really high nitrate concentrations in our groundwater. We also have some really sensitive areas in the state with karst topography where the water gets into groundwater pretty easily, pretty rapidly. So it's going to take everything with it. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of different aspects that we have to manage.
So we're going to be talking today about the use of cover crops to help with our nutrient management mm-hmm. goals. So currently, how common is it for dairy farmers in Wisconsin to be incorporating cover crops? Is it quite common now, or is it still in a stage of trying to encourage more farmers to be introducing cover crops either as a relay crop or post-harvest?
That's a good question that I don't know. I wish I knew the numbers on that. I'll put it like this. The farmers that I interact with are generally the ones that are using cover crops. So my view of it is often quite biased, but I think some of the survey data shows that it's still not, widely used. However, in the state, I think that when they are used are quite often by dairy farmers because where there's a great opportunity in the state after corn silage harvest, which can happen as early as late August and can go into September. It's an opportunity where cover crops can get planted and grow.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, I suspect this won't be all that necessary for our listenership, but it never hurts to talk about the chemistry happening when we apply manure and just like the physics and chemistry of the movement, whether it's phosphorus as runoff or nitrogen leaching. Can you talk about the application of manure and how that translates into this movement that we're so concerned about?
Okay, so we think about what's in manure, right? I guess that's the place to start. And we think about, okay, we have nitrogen and phosphorus, which are two, key elements and two big crop nutrients. So, but in the manure itself, the nitrogen and the phosphorus exist in an organic form. It's not necessarily a lot in the immediately plant available form. So what happens is as manure is applied, the nitrogen that's found in the organic forms gets what we call mineralized. It becomes plant available through soil biological processes. So the soil microorganisms convert it into plant available forms. But in doing so, we make it plant available, but it also can exist in a form where it could be leached to groundwater. Which there's so many caveats to this, and that's why if you notice I'm kind of stumbling through it. But so that's the aspect. So it's not an immediately available form, so it has to mineralize, and that creates a lot of variation in terms of how much nitrogen is actually going to be available from the manure to whatever crop that you want to supply it to as a nutrient source. But then we think about phosphorus, and the reason why this gets I brought up nitrogen first because it's the element that's needed in the biggest quantity. But the nitrogen phosphorus ratios are such that if you're applying a lot of nitrogen, if you want to apply your manure to meet your nitrogen demands, you're probably exceeding your phosphorus needs. And so this has led to like the historic applications of manure on different fields have led to this building of phosphorus in the soil. So the interesting thing about phosphorus mm-hmm. is that it does bind to the soil, right? So that's why we can have this buildup and buildup and buildup. But at some point that the buildup gets to be so high that you have a big amount of this phosphorus that's in the soil, when we have runoff happen off the landscape, it can start to extract some of that phosphorus from the soil surface and move it off-site into the surface waters. So we just have an issue mm-hmm. where if we have a lot of manure being applied in a small region, you can have a buildup and it really creates this environmental risk.
Okay, so sticking with some basics then, it also doesn't hurt just to talk about some of the environmental benefits we're after when we plant a cover crop, either just, you know, during the cropping season to take over after harvest or post-harvest, and presumably post-manure application. So what can we hope to do with cover crops to start to prevent some of this pollution?
Well, so cover crops do what we want them to do, right? If they're going to grow, we want them to cover the soil. So when we talk about our production systems in Midwest agriculture, we try to, most of our crops utilize as much of the growing season as possible. So we're in the Corn Belt. So there's corn, soybean, those crops dominate our production systems. We try to utilize all the growing degree days. We try to utilize all the sunlight that we can for production of those crops. What that generally means is that there's not much time left over at the end of the growing season to plant a cover crop to get some erosion control benefits and water quality benefits. However, for dairy production, we harvest corn as corn silage, right? We're taking off the entire corn plant. We're doing that much earlier in the growing mm-hmm. season. So we're harvesting in August, September. Then the downside of that is that it is leaving that soil exposed. There's no crop residue on that soil surface. On the flip side, it does give an opportunity where you can plant a cover crop and get it to grow pretty successfully. So this is that sweet spot that we're talking about, where there's an opportunity where we need cover crops to exist to provide the soil coverage, right, for the erosion control, right? You can imagine a green lawn is preventing, there's less erosion, you know, and all the things that people think about when they think about erosion, soil leaving the landscape, the gullies that could form, right? That's going to do a much better job than obviously bare soil. So there's the opportunity right there. Okay, so then we can get a cover crop growing, all right? So, well, what else is probably going to happen mm-hmm. at that time? If it's a dairy farm, always looking for fields where we can get manure applied, there's only so much storage that of the manure that can occur on any single dairy farm. So it provides an opportunity to get manure out onto the land.
Can I stop you there? I was actually going to ask you a question about, at least in the Wisconsin context, but why, you know, given we have concerns about a movement of nutrients where we don't want them, I could think of three reasons why farmers are going to want to apply in the fall versus waiting to the spring. And I just wanted to know what the primary reasons are. I can see a benefit to waiting to the spring. I can also assume that there are big barriers or challenges to doing it. So why are farmers desirous? You just mentioned that they don't have unlimited space for their manure. Are there other reasons that farmers are inclined to apply in the fall instead of the spring?
Well, I think that's the biggest one, right? So it's a nutrient source, but it's also a waste product, right? So, there's just times of year where the pits get full and they need to be applied. So, I think it's just sort of an unfortunate, you know, aspect of dairy farming is that the manure has to go out in the fall so far in advance of, planting the next crop.
Right. Okay. So anyway, you've highlighted that our cover crops are, first of all, just going to help prevent erosion. And then presumably they're also just going to kind of store, otherwise mobile nutrients, that have arrived in the soil via the manure.
So when we apply manure, it's applied in a form of, that's an organic nitrogen form, right? And that nitrogen, most of the nitrogen in the manure is not available to plants. Some of it is in the ammonium form. So plants are looking for ammonium or nitrate, and those are considered the ions of which how nitrogen is consumed by the plant. So we apply this manure. It's got all this nitrogen in it, but it needs to become plant available. The soil microbes do that. And then, but when that happens and ammonium forms, ammonium gets converted very quickly to nitrate. And when nitrate exists in soil, it doesn't bind to the soil the way phosphorus does. So nitrogen flows with the water. So now you got to imagine you've got nitrogen flowing through your soil. it's moving the nitrogen, or so you got water moving through your soil, you got now you got the nitrogen moving with it. So we got the cover crops out there to try to achieve our erosion goal, right? We don't want erosion to happen. So it's keeping the soil on the landscape, but it's also growing. It's a plant. It's taking up nitrogen. So now you've got a situation where you're controlling erosion and you're taking up nitrogen, preventing nitrogen, that nitrate that was going to be leached out. The cover crops are starting to grab that, take that up, and now you've reduced the amount of nitrate you've lost to groundwater, especially over those fall conditions.
Sorry, one more question, which is just like another obvious one, but let's just have you say it out loud anyway. It has been well demonstrated that using cover crops for this purpose to manage manage nutrients post-harvest or post-manure application are effective at reducing the kinds of pollution you've been talking about.
That is correct. I am not the first one to have studied these things. Yes, no, there's a lot of good evidence, a lot of good data to demonstrate the benefits of cover crops in reducing nitrate leaching in groundwater.
Okay, but as the research that we're going to kind of focus on today looked at or discussed or examined, we also have to be aware that there can be, for all the benefits we might see environmentally, there can be trade-offs in terms of the agronomic focus, I suppose. And so I want to talk a little bit about that today. So I guess I'll ask you this way. When we plant these cover crops with these environmental goals in mind, what are some of the agronomic trade-offs we need to keep in mind as well?
So for when it comes to cover crops, two key sort of agronomic trade-offs we have to keep in mind. What's the effect on that next crop's yield? And what's the, how much nitrogen do you need to apply to that next crop? You're going to put out manure, and you're putting out manure in the fall. Maybe you're putting it in September, maybe a little later. But you're not planting that next corn crop, right, till April of the following year. Mm-hmm. So that's a lot of time for that manure to be out there. It mineralizes, becomes plant available, and then has the potential to leach out. So you get that cover crop out there, that cover crop's taking up that nitrogen, right? All those water, get those water quality benefits. And in a perfect world, it would just take up the nitrogen that was going to leach out anyway. But in reality, it actually takes up more than that. It takes up some nitrogen that would be available to that next corn crop. So you need to supplement back some of that nitrogen in terms of, as inorganic fertilizer to that next corn crop. So for example, if you were a farmer and you put out, let's say 10,000 gallons of liquid dairy manure based on this, based on the testing of the manure, which I always recommend, by the way, always valuable to test the manure, and that we get an estimate of the amount of nitrogen that might be available. So let's say you put out that manure and you were expecting 90 pounds. It was going to supply about 90 pounds of nitrogen to that next corn crop. If we're using a cover crop, it has the potential to reduce that. There's a lot of factors along the way that'll dictate how much it could be reduced. But using a cover crop, let's say like winter rye, sometimes that we're going to see that's going to take up nitrogen. I would one of the estimates is if you get about 1,000 pounds of dry matter biomass, if you get basically half a ton of dry matter out there in the cover crop, it's not going to supply 90, it's only going to supply 55 pounds of nitrogen. Mm-hmm. So, based on our research, we're using some estimates of you have to change, we refer to this as the manure nitrogen credit, right? So you're putting out that manure, you need to credit it as a fertilizer source in your nutrient management plans, and we have an estimate of how much to credit. But that cover crop reduces that credit. I don't know if that's if I'm making much sense there, but
totally,
so it does influence.
Totally makes sense, yeah.
So it's if you're following a nutrient management plan and you're using a cover crop, you need to factor that in to your availability of nitrogen from your manure.
Right. And so we're going to get into a little more detail about that. But in terms of some of the research that I read that you folks were involved with, can you talk about species selection for cover cropping?
Yeah.
So in this context, we're talking mainly about corn silage crops. and the timing of planting of a cover crop that applies to after a manure application in the fall. What species did you zero in on in the Wisconsin context?
So what we've been studying the grass, different grass cover crops. And we've done that just because they're the ones where we can get the most consistent success in terms of establishment and growth. So, but even within those grass cover crops, there's still some variation in them. So I kind of put them into three bins: the ones that will winter kill, the ones that will sometimes survive the winter, and ones that will generally always survive the winter. So mm-hmm. If you start with the ones that generally winter kill, common ones here would be spring barley or oats. So those are ones where you put out you grow, it's gonna establish pretty nice in the fall, but then it's gonna die over the winter. So you don't have to find a way to terminate it in the spring. Pros and cons though, right? So less to manage, but then you don't get any sort of spring, control or any additional benefits over the spring season. Mm-hmm. What we saw with this is that whenever we grew spring barley, it did a good job. It actually had decent amount of nitrogen uptake over, providing some water quality benefits over that fall, but did not seem to affect the availability of nitrogen from the manure. So that was an interesting part. But trade-offs, we saw, we go out there in the spring and you look at the field. Sometimes there was enough kind of dead biomass there, and if it looked like, okay, this could have some maybe erosion control in the spring, but often that just sort of decomposed, kind of fell apart pretty easily, and it wasn't really helpful in providing erosion control in the spring. I like to promote it's kind of like a starter cover crop. If you want to try something and get something going, it's a good one to start with.
Yeah, good one to start with, yeah. if you want to avoid, don't want to mess with some of the, if you don't want to have to be worrying about, a higher level of agronomic trade-off. That's what I'm hearing from you is you get less environmental benefit overall, but also less complications in terms of trade-off exactly. in the spring growth with the spring growth and what that does to your eventual next crop.
Exactly. Yeah. And one of the problems is you gotta, if it does survive the winter, which gets into our other ones, the ones that survive the winter, we have to go out, and you generally have to, spray it out chemically. You could plow it under, but then you're kind of defeating the purpose, in my opinion. But you've got to go spray it out, but then the field conditions have to be right to go spray it out. So sometimes it gets a little stressful with field operations.
Okay, so can you continue on with these other species?
Yeah. So the one that I call sometimes dies and sometimes doesn't, this might be a specific Wisconsin thing where we grew annual ryegrass in a lot of our trials. And so this is different than winter rye. So annual ryegrass, sometimes referred to as Italian ryegrass. And it's been popular in other parts of the United States as a cover crop. And what we found is it sometimes survived the winter and sometimes didn't. And often it just it grew back patchy in the spring. So it was like one of the ones that kind of fell in the in-between of consistency. So it kind of left us with, well, we're not quite sure of what to do with it. Mm-hmm. But in contrast, winter rye, or sometimes referred to as cereal rye, that was the one that we had the biggest success with in terms of establishment, and it always survived the winters. And so we had we have good green soil coverage in the fall, green growing soil coverage in the spring. The trade-off, right, just like we mentioned, is you got to find time to go out there and terminate. So based on these the results from winter rye, this is the winter rye, the ones that survive the winter, and then that start to put on a lot of biomass or a lot of growth. That's where we start to see the nitrogen issue come into play, right? But again, it's all
so can
all
I
kind of make oh so yeah go ahead.
No, sorry, I'm going to stop you there because now I just want to clarify a few details from the research that we're referencing.
You bet.
So just because I know listeners will be interested. So the manure application target in this research was between, I'm just taking this from a summary of the research, was between 72 and 100 pounds nitrogen per acre.
Mm-hmm.
We're talking about a situation like if we think about that winter rye or any of the cover crops that survived the winter, we're talking about a chemical kill. Right.
Yes,
and correct. Followed by and that those cover crops were drill seeded in the fall.
They were all drill seeded. That is correct. Yep.
Right. Okay. So sorry, I just wanted to add that context before we discuss this some more. So as you said, winter rye is going to give us the most potential environmental benefits because of that surge of growth in the spring that is going to continue to provide those environmental benefits. But then we need to start. That's just going to take a little bit more forethought and even skill to manage that properly so it doesn't unduly impact our next crop, correct?
That's correct. And the trick is, this whole trick is the total amount of growth that happens. So when we did all of this work, we saw conditions, if we got about half a ton to a ton of dry matter. So we take a quadrat, take some biomass samples, dry it down, get the weight. If it was between 1,000 and 2,000, our recommendation is that subtract 35 pounds from the nitrogen that you thought was going to be out there. So just subtract 35 pounds. When it was cases when it got really big, which happened usually in cases where it was a long fall, and we had a lot of growth over the fall, especially with that winter rye, if we got above 2,000 pounds or a ton of dry matter, that really starts to, the cover crop really kind of starts, it just acts like its own crop, right? It takes up a lot of nitrogen, and in most cases kind of wiped out kind of the manure nitrogen credit overall. So if we're getting above 2,000 pounds of dry matter, it's wiping out the nitrogen. There wasn't any additional nitrogen available to that next corn crop.
Right. So timing is key in terms of, balancing out the benefits of environmental benefits with the potential agronomic trade-offs. Timing of termination is key. What I took from your research was that actually around the 1,000 pounds per acre of biomass is maybe an ideal to try and hit up when you're ready in terms of when to terminate.
That's actually a pretty good number. I think there's a sweet spot in there where you want enough biomass or enough growth where you get that soil coverage, right? Where you get that environmental, the water or the erosion control, but you don't want too much biomass where it starts to deplete the soil of nitrogen for that next crop. So 1,000 pounds is a good number, anywhere between 1,000 to maybe 1,500 pounds is a good target. But it does demonstrate it's about, to us, it seems the name of the game is growth. And there's other ways you can control growth, though. And this is another, some of our more recent work. We've ratcheted down the seeding rate of our cover crop. A lot of our earlier work on cover crops, our rates were maybe closer to, 70 to 90 pounds of seed per acre. And we've really ratcheted that down in a lot of our more recent work. We can get really good soil coverage with only 30 pounds per acre seeding rate of winter rye. So that would be a half to a third of some of these earlier studies, where we can still get almost the same amount of soil coverage and minimize the effect on nitrogen that's sort of captured that you have to supplement back to that next corn crop.
Right. Okay. And then a couple minutes ago, you referenced sometimes the way the fall and the spring go, you can end up with more biomass than ideal.
Yeah.
I saw a reference in the research that at some point when you're past 2,000 pounds biomass per acre, when that measurement is in dry matter. Is that correct?
That's in dry matter, right? That is correct. Yeah.
Okay. So at some point, then the recommendation is try to actually turn that cover crop and that biomass into a silage crop. Like that would be the way to deal with that situation. Is that do you still believe that's a good approach?
Right. If you're growing that, if you have that much biomass and you have the ability to harvest it as a silage crop, as a winter silage crop, and ensile it and have it dialed in where you know how to ensile it and feed it, then I think that's a great option, because then you at least get some value for that biomass. If not, just know that you're going to be really limited in the amount of nitrogen. You know, you're going to have to supplement a lot of nitrogen back. A third option to this whole thing, though, too, is all that biomass is good for the soil. So if you're on a field that where your goal is, you know, soil health improvement, and you have the ability to grow, you know, cover crops quite often, that's another key to try to improving soil health is frequent use of cover crops. The more biomass you can grow is gonna over the long term is gonna benefit the soil. But of course, there's a trade-off, right, with crop production.
But doesn't that just imply then, and this has come up a couple times in this interview, that then in that case, whether you've accidentally grown too much biomass just because the conditions got away on you, like that you couldn't control, or because you're doing it on purpose because of the other benefits to soil health down the line, it just implies higher fertilizer costs ultimately, like that you're just going to have to add more fertilizer, like to balance things out.
That is true. That would be the case. However, right, if you're applying nitrogen, it's all of these trade-offs. So unfortunately, fall manure applications are part of our dairy production systems, and they are what, it's the cause of a lot of, you know, environmental risk. So the trade-off has to come somewhere. I often use the phrase, you know, there's a price to be paid to the conservation gods, and that price is nitrogen. So, but again, I would rather have that nitrogen be stored in a cover crop, getting incorporated hopefully over long terms into the soil organic matter than leach out. So, but on the flip side, I can't say that there isn't risk. Of course, there is real risk in terms of cost of nitrogen and needing to get that nitrogen supplemented. But it is the trade-off.
Okay, and so now that kind of leads me into like my next question, and at least this might partly just be based on a misunderstanding on my part.
Oh,
Matt, okay. But I want to during my note taking, I was thinking about, okay, in cases where we've grown a lot of biomass, either on purpose because we want organic matter in our soil, or just because the growing conditions led to more biomass than intended. So
right.
In that situation, the crop is taken up. I'm just going to generalize, you know, all of the nitrogen that would have otherwise been available to the next cash crop from the original manure application, right?
Right.
The whole point of the cover crop generally is those environmental benefits. Can we actually accidentally create a result later on where there's potentially worse environmental benefit, environmental outcomes? What I mean, can it ever be a situation where, okay, so we get to planting that next cash crop, we have to now add the nitrogen fertilizer because we don't have it available because the cover crop kind of took all that benefit away in growing. Later on, does that result in too much nitrogen in the system? And I'll just add to that, that's a question I had about a potential like negative outcome. Versus I also wondered about a positive outcome where, like, we haven't talked about, okay, the cover crop takes up all this nitrogen that isn't available at time of planting the next cash crop, but doesn't it just become available later? And doesn't that allow us to smooth out our fertilizer applications in a sense? Because now we know that nitrogen is coming later once that crop ultimately is fully broken down.
Well, no, I'm laughing because, I mean, you've touched on a couple parts that I don't know if I have we have a full answer to, but and it's complicated, right? And it's really interesting. So like the first, the idea is, okay, so if we take up the nitrogen manure, we have to supplement more nitrogen with inorganic fertilizer or commercial fertilizer, is that creating an additional water quality issue? So the flip side of that argument would be, is if you didn't put out the manure to begin with, you would still have needed to apply that this nitrogen, right? So that gets into, oh, how efficient can we be with our in-season nitrogen applications? And generally speaking, I feel like we can be a lot more efficient with our nitrogen when it's in a fertilizer, in the commercial fertilizer form, because it's way more predictable in terms of its availability. So versus manure just comes with a lot more inherent risk of availability. So yes, you have to supplement more. Does that mean more potential nitrogen leaching losses in season compared to if you have to apply less? So perhaps, you know, how does that all balance out? I still feel like we're probably up more, you know, or in terms of water quality benefits with use of that cover crop than without. Mm-hmm. So overall, we're still, I think it's still a net positive. And especially if it's only a condition where you have to supplement 35 pounds or 30 more pounds or so. So that's why I'm really recommending not going to that 2,000 pound or more range if possible, right? Because that, you know, that's creating a lot of other tricky aspects in the system. Okay, but then you hit a huge issue and a huge topic, right? It's that the idea of that cover crop, growing that cover crop that's trapping the nitrogen, it's decomposing, and it's, you know, hopefully getting, you know, at least a portion of it assimilated into the organic matter. And when does that nitrogen ever release and become available to plants? And so the problem with rye is its decomposition patterns aren't in, you know, don't occur at the same time when the corn needs the nitrogen. So that's always the issue, is that the release of any nitrogen from that cover crop biomass isn't happening at a time when the corn needs it. That said, there's some longer term. So you're never going to get that nitrogen back in season from a grass cover crop, unfortunately. It's just the way the grass cover crop operates and the way it, the decomposition patterns. So quick aside, that's in contrast to any sort of legume biomass, like a clover or like a vetch. Those decompose, when those plant materials decompose, they decompose in better synchrony. They decompose and supply nitrogen at the time when the crop needs it. And so those are cover crops that are definitely supplying nitrogen to a corn crop. So it becomes a long-term game. So can you utilize cover crops for long periods of time where you've built up this pool of nitrogen in your soil, where you've stimulated microbial activity and do all of these things to eventually cut back on your nitrogen over time? And so that's kind of maybe where some of the goals of, you know, soil health building come into place. But unfortunately, we don't have a lot of information on that. It requires many years, perhaps a decade is kind of a number that a lot of us throw out in terms of continual use of a soil health building practice to try to gain that benefit. So over the short term, there's no nitrogen coming back to you from grass cover crops.
Okay, but I'm always aware of how reluctant an academic will be to make kind of conclusive statements. But what I think I'm hearing is like the running hope or assumption, though, is if you think about a 10-year timeline and say you hold steady, like on a fairly predictable way, the crops you're growing, let's just say you're doing corn silage on corn silage year after year. You're, and if we assume a similar manure application that we hold every year at the end of the harvest, the hope or goal would be that over a longer timeline, we could be ultimately reducing our fertilizer costs.
Yeah.
Because that eventually, you know, you've got this bank of nitrogen that if you're managing it well, can stick around and benefit you much later.
Yes. No, I agree with that. And the trick is, and the reason why, yeah, you got me, right? I'm hesitant to make conclusive statements. And it's because it probably requires the type of system that you said, where it's, if it's continual silage and you always had the cover crop there, versus if silage is grown in rotation and you're only getting a cover crop once every 3 years or 4 years, that's not enough, right? That's not enough cover crop use over that time period. If you had a decade's worth of cover crop use, you're going to see those benefits. I feel that's a pretty fair statement to make.
Okay, so Matthew, we only have a few minutes left together, and the very end of my notes here, I just like wrote down relay cropping. I really don't have anything more specific than that. I know that that's something you can speak to and we haven't spoken to yet. Like, so you can take this in any direction you want, whether it's directly related to nutrient management, like benefits or other benefits. What, you know, if we stick with similar crops or we stick with dairy, you know, if we have a few minutes to talk about this, where do you want to take the topic of, you know, interseeding or relay cropping with a cover crop while the cash crop is still in the ground?
That is certainly a growth area, and one that, again, we have a hard time with in the upper Midwest. We've done a lot of trials with interseeding. So we're talking about getting a cash crop started, then interseeding, drill seeding a cover crop into the standing, typically it's a corn crop, and let's see what happens. So this one's another one where it depends on the species. Now, you need obviously good growing conditions and all that for it to grow, but the grasses, they kind of do okay, but sometimes the grasses need that sunlight. So a lot of times we'll see that if your corn crop is pretty good and starts to, you know, form that canopy and kind of smother out the cover crops, those grasses, they start reaching for that sunlight and get really spindly. When it's a clover, though, we've had some success with red clover. If you can get the red clover interseeded, the clover will get out of the ground, but it doesn't mind like hanging out in the shadows. One of the common systems, a real popular one here, is we frost seed. We call it frost seeding into winter wheat. The winter wheat's been planted in the fall. We go out and maybe this time of year and we'll broadcast seed red clover, but the wheat takes off first and that red clover just gets going and hangs out underneath in that understory. Then you take off the winter wheat and you got a beautiful stand of red clover underneath ready to go. The trouble is we just have a consistency issue with, like, sometimes we can get that red clover to grow really well in that corn canopy, and sometimes we can't. One system I think that deserves more exploration, though, is interseeding into those fields that we're going to harvest as corn silage, because that silage is going to come off a lot sooner. It's going to give that red clover more time to bulk up in the fall. But that's an area, that's a growth area in sort of research and experimentation that needs to be done. But that's probably the place where we can have some big benefit to using cover crops.
But in that case, are we still talking largely about the goal of eventual nutrient management? What I mean is, like, you, in the other context we spent most of our time discussing, we're kind of limited to grass crops because of the time of year they're getting planted. Is the idea that here, you know, relay cropping allows us to more selection for what we can get in the ground as a cover crop that eventually, though, is going to serve the same purpose of, like, we're going to then eventually apply manure over the leftover cover crop and then realize the same goals, or are you mainly talking about other goals with an intersown cover crop?
Oh, that's a good aspect. So I guess I am talking about mostly other aspects. So I don't think, from my experience, we just have not got enough successful establishment of the cover crop when interseeded where it's going to provide a real water quality benefit. I think at least in our environments here in Wisconsin, we're just a little bit too far north. Now, so in terms of like applying manure onto this like existing cover crop, the cover crop just isn't going to be big enough or be healthy enough to start to really provide some water quality benefits. Now, the legumes like that, like a red clover, it's going to provide some benefit in terms of if you have a nice stand of a red clover, we talk about, and then you terminate it, you plow it under or chemically kill it. When that decomposes, it can release a lot of nitrogen to the next crop. So it's like the flip side of the rye, where instead it's going to actually supply 40 to 60 pounds of nitrogen to that next crop. So because it's decomposing and it's releasing it, so sort of the opposite effect. But that doesn't tie in. That's not involved with any sort of manure management at all, though. So it's kind of a different topic.
Okay, well, I'm sure we could go on and on about, about relay cropping and cover crops in general, but our time is rapidly ending together. Matthew, thank you so much for joining me on the podcast to share some of your knowledge with our listenership.
Yeah, no, it was great chatting with you.
All right, so that's it for another episode of the Organic BC Podcast. Thanks to Matthew Rourke for giving me that interview, and also thanks to Matt Eckel, who produced the intro and outro music for this podcast. I'm Jordan Marr, your host, and I also co-produce this podcast with Sarah Stewart. Sarah, thanks for all the help you've been giving me in the background on a lot of these episodes. That's it for now, everyone. I hope to talk to you soon. Take care. This episode of the Organic BC Podcast was funded in part by Agriculture and Agri-Food Canada through the BC Climate Agri-Solutions Fund, delivered by Investment Agriculture Foundation of BC.